Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, here he is, Brock Romanek with his Big Legal Minds podcast.
Welcome to Big Legal Minds. I'm Brock Romanek, editor of thecorporatecounsel.net, deallawyers.com, and compensationstandards.com. My guests today, Chris Vico and Sherry Sorokin, have been working their magic in the corporate governance area for a combined 60 years. They are the queens of board evaluations. Chris has served in the role of being the primary governance officer at two companies, most recently McKesson, and before that, AirTouch Communications, now known as Vodafone. She's been running her own shop for quite some time now, helping out many boards with their evaluations and succession issues. Sherry served as a primary governance officer at Bank of America for over 20 years, and most recently joined Chris at the Vico Group. Their consultancy style is perfect for the type of environment that working with boards requires, restrained, yet firm and strong. Their long tenure being in-house allows them to bring that practical perspective to bear for their sensitive assignments. They are highly sought after in the Bay Area where they are based, but also around the country. So we're here at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs. This is an unplanned podcast. I just hijacked Sherry and Chris, and they're in my hotel room. And Sherry, give us a little bit of flavor of yourself, your career. Where'd you grow up? How about that? Where are you from?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, and I went to law school at Northwestern after having been a Spanish teacher for a number of years, and I decided I wanted to do something different. So I went to Northwestern Law School, and I was lucky enough to be hired by Bank of America right out of law school. I was an intern there between my junior and senior year, and they were opening a really small loan production office. Back in those days, you couldn't branch interstate, and they put a legal department there. So I went right from law school into that.
And you moved all the way out to California?
And I moved to California a number of years later. I got divorced, and at that time, Bank of America was under a lot of pressure to put women in executive positions, and they said, oh my God, here's a woman, she's single, she's been in our law department, we can move her. And so I moved to California.
So how long had you been at B of A before you made the move?
Well, if you're talking about moving to California, I moved in about 83, I think I was. So I joined in 77, moved in 83, and I became corporate secretary in 86.
So you'd been doing loan stuff for about six years.
Yeah, and loan and big leases. Secretary. Yeah.
Did you even know what the corporate secretary function was when they asked you to do it?
I had really only a very vague idea about what it was about. And I was asked to interview for the job with that, and I had to kind of run around and look it up and talk to people who had been corporate secretaries before.
Was your predecessor still there, or was
yes,
this
a, yeah. Yeah. So Al Ulbricht was my predecessor, and we overlapped about 3 months. Bank of America was in the middle of an unplanned takeover. Somebody was trying to take them over. I think it was Sandy Weill at the time, and so they kept. Thank God they kept Al on the job until that was resolved, and then I became at the annual meeting in '86.
It's my recollection that at least when I started getting to know the corporate secretary function, I met a number of people that had been in unrelated departments and then all of a sudden were moved into the corporate secretary's function. And I think that's quite rare today. It still does happen occasionally, but the importance of the job is definitely more recognized now. It probably has always been that important, but I think
you're absolutely right. I mean, when I took the job, it was had been traditionally a rotating position, sort of a development role for attorneys in the legal department, and most attorneys went to the corporate secretary's office for a couple of years, and then when I took the job, it turned into a more permanent position. So I was in it about 10 years, I think, or maybe 12.
And how long altogether?
Well, I was at B of A for 22 years, so I don't know, subtract six from that. I was the corporate secretary for a long time.
Yeah,
it was a great job. It's the best job I ever had, certainly. Really loved it.
All right, Chris, now you're on the hot seat. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Northern California, Sacramento, and I grew up here. when it came time for high school, my father was, who was a bank manager.
You grew up at the Broadmoor?
No, no, in California, sorry. Can we start that again?
No.
So in California, my father was a bank manager and was transferred to Delano, California, and that was at the height of the farm worker movement. And my mother ended up as a teacher. She taught Cesar Chavez, one of his kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it didn't seem like it was going to be a good fit for me. I had another year of high school, and I was, you know, a little worried about that environment. And so I went down and finished my high school in Mexico. There's an American school in Guadalajara. So I did high school there. I audited some classes at the University of Guadalajara, stayed for a couple of years, and really had a very interesting time there. And then I came back and started at University of California at Davis, and then on to Hastings Law School, where I graduated. And right out of law school, I went to the California Public Utilities Commission, first in the appellate department, and within a few months there was a new commissioner appointed, and his name was Bill Bagley. He's a well-known former state legislator here in California, and also had a federal appointment under the Gerald Ford administration. Anyway, he liked me, we liked each other, and he thought that I was Italian, that he thought my name was Italian, and because he's really Bill Baglietto, he gave me the job, and so as his legal advisor. And so I told him eventually that I wasn't Italian, but I continued to work for him as his legal advisor. And that was probably one of the best jobs I've had, because you're up at the top of the commission, you get to see what's going on, you know all of the issues, and you're there to represent your commissioner when there are staff meetings and so on. So it was really fun.
Yeah, I worked for a commissioner at the SEC, and the same thing. You get to see at the top level, but not yet spend your entire day in the dregs.
And then when he left, I didn't want to go back down into the, you know, sort of the lower part of the organization. I liked, you know, sort of being there and really knowing what's going on. And so the Pacific Telesis Group hired me, and I was the first hire out of the Public Utilities Commission for many, many years, because their former general counsel had said, or maybe it was one of the staff attorneys said, don't ever hire anyone who'd come out of the Public Utilities Commission. And luckily, he had just retired, and so they brought me in and put me in the securities group. And I didn't have securities background, but I went over to Bolt and audited a class. Larry Sonsini was teaching it.
Wow.
And so came back in and started practicing in the securities group. And the securities group was also responsible for supporting the board and the corporate secretary function. And so I got a little bit of exposure to all of that while there. And then I was part of the spinoff of AirTouch Communications from Pacific Telesis Group, which was, you know, the wireless operations of the company. And so I went and headed the corporate securities group at AirTouch. And so as part of my responsibilities, I had the corporate secretary function, had people, and, you know, we had the securities and the disclosure and the subsidiaries, and I don't think we had stock administration. We had shareholder relations and that sort of thing. So we did that for a few years. We had a great board. That also was a really good job. I really liked that one. But it was a very much of a startup environment, but we were taking over, really. It felt like a hostile takeover to the people in the existing company. They'd been an operating division. Suddenly they were a public company.
Yeah.
And so we had to put in place all of the public company processes.
It's culture shock.
It really was. And we just worked kind of around the clock, but it was great. It was really great fun. I liked it.
So how'd you wind up at McKesson?
Well, after a while of operating in that kind of startup environment, you realize that you probably haven't seen your kid enough, and that it's probably time to take a break. So after, I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years, I decided to take some time off. And so I took a year and hung out with my little girl and remodeled the house, did things that I wanted to do for a little while. And then I was approached by the folks at McKesson, because their longtime corporate secretary, Nancy Miller, who left me with a beautiful organization, by the way. Anyway, Nancy was also very involved in the Society of Corporate Secretaries, yeah. But she was retiring, and they needed someone to take her place. And so they asked me, and I thought, well, you know, it's downtown San Francisco. It felt like about half of the job that I had had at AirTouch, but, you know, I could be closer to home. And so I took it, and within a few weeks of being there, we learned that a company that McKesson had just acquired had been overstating its revenues.
No.
It was the old HBO medical software company. And so all of a sudden, the earnings that we had just released were no longer good. You know, I mean, we were at the first combined board meeting where this all came out, and it was just so, it was just kind of crazy for a while. So I really, so then all of a sudden the pace changed, you know. We're back to, you know, calling for board meetings on Sundays, yeah. And it was just board meeting after board meeting after, and responding to all of the requests that we were getting. I think there were like 90 lawsuits ultimately. So I got to know the company really well in a very short time. You know, all of the records, we had to reproduce all of the records.
Wow.
So that was fun. We did
baptism
that.
By fire.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Sherry. So what are the noticeable things you've seen in the corporate governance world? One, of course, corporate governance is now a household name, and it wasn't 15 years ago. But what's your sense in terms of practical, on the ground practicing?
Well, when I first became corporate secretary back in the 80s, corporate governance as a profession barely existed, really. There was just starting to be interest among investors and activists. And now it's a major focus of what the corporate secretary's role is. When I started out, it was pretty much more of an administrative task. And it, of course, you became a confidant of the CEO and of the board chair, but that it was really about managing day-to-day kinds of things. Now, the role of the corporate secretary, you really have to be a governance professional. You have to know what is out there, what people are interested in. As far as the board is concerned, you have to be able to explain governance trends to the board of directors. You have to be able to hire people to come in and do board evaluations and skills assessments and translate sometimes the results of those to the board, follow up with what is being suggested in those kinds of evaluations. It's become a much more, I would say, much more professional job, more executive job than it used to be. And at the same time, you still have to manage all the administrative things. You still have to make sure the company's filings are up to date. You still have to supervise, at least, if not be involved in the proxy process. But you also have to talk to investors. You have to coordinate with investor relations, which, again, I think my first year, I didn't even know who was in charge of investor relations. And by the time I left Bank of America, the investor relations guy and I were best buddies professionally because we had to be. We were both working with the investment community. So it's a totally, I think, totally different job now than it was when I started. And it's probably as much fun, I have to say. But you're balancing so many more things than you used to have to balance, I think. And it was already, when I left, it was an 80-hour-a-week job. You had to know where everybody was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in case you had to call a special board meeting. The pressure for earnings is much more intense, I think, now than it used to be. And balancing that against doing the right thing for your employees, doing the right thing in the community, your reputation, huge cyber risks that you didn't have before. So it's a much more intense job than when I started out.
So Chris, what about the shrink side of all this? Because that's always what fascinates me, that this corporate secretaries community, a big role that they have is playing shrink, because the board dynamics is so important. And then even the corporate secretary's relationship to the board via management is in sort of a tricky position. Do you think that's changed at all because directors are now under more pressure to spend time doing the job, as well as, you know, there might be global directors, there might be distance and communication issues?
Well, I think it's going to depend on the people involved as to whether or not there's that component that you're talking about, and in part the relationship between the corporate secretary and the CEO. If the corporate secretary is a really valued member and of the group and working with the board and not viewed as someone, sometimes you'll find a CEO is hesitant about the relationship that the corporate secretary may have with the board because they want to, you know, sort of be at the center of things. So it really depends on these relationships. But the corporate secretary gets to know so much about the board because, you know what they like to eat, you know all of their, you work with them on travel plans, you just get to know who they are, and because you work with them on
their families.
Yeah, sure. And spouses, especially when they're, if there are strategy retreats where spouses come, or occasionally there'll be events where families are invited. And so, yes, absolutely, you kind of get to know them because of all of these things. And they know if you're doing your job right, they know they can rely on you to get whatever needs to be done.
I found that good corporate secretaries have such close relationship with the directors that if they do need to make a move to another job, oftentimes it's because a director they know helps place them.
Or certainly acts as a reference. I've certainly found that, yeah. That they'll be good references for you. Yeah. But what I was just thinking about when I first, again, at Pacific Telesis Group, the corporate secretary function was managed by not lawyers, by, you know, paralegals. And so the role was a different one. So our role was more to draft resolutions for them, but they took care of the day-to-day relationship with the board. And I saw that change with the AirTouch spinoff, and that was 94, that we were much more, that the lawyers were much more involved with the board. And then again with McKesson, of course, it was clear that you want a lawyer to be the run the corporate secretary's office, be the corporate secretary, just because of the legal implications of the corporate governance job. And it, you know, the corporate governance was coming into after Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, there was a greater focus on it. I would say that every board that I've been involved with and when I was in-house all had good solid procedures with their directors. And when Sarbanes-Oxley came into place, we had to just tweak things because somebody else had written the legislation that said you have to do it this way, but we already had those processes in place. And Sherry and I both ran into CalPERS in the early 90s when they started grading companies on their corporate governance. And we both got A's from CalPERS once they really understood our governance practices and processes. And that was not true for a lot of other companies. So I think it's changed in that regard, too.
Did you put that on your resume that you got an A?
No. No.
All right, let's talk about your day jobs now. Chris and Sherry are third-party board evaluators. This is the process where boards, I guess, are encouraged but not required. Are they required to have space? They're not. They're encouraged to have it in their corporate governance guidelines by both the NYC and NASDAQ, not required.
I think the New York Stock Exchange wants boards to do an annual board evaluation, but they don't tell you how.
And it's pretty universal that companies do this, and sometimes they hire a third party to come in. And I've recommended Chris on numerous occasions. She's one of the first, if not the first, to act in that role, based on your vast experience. And so you've been doing that over 10 years, I think, right?
Feels like that, around there, yeah.
So what's the process for a third-party evaluator let's start even just the initial call. What sort of concerns does the corporate secretary mm-hmm. usually have about using a third party?
Well, I think that the idea of using a third party is one that's growing, because I think there's a recognition that to continue doing these sort of regular questionnaires year after year, and they come into the corporate secretary or the chair of the governance committee, and that just feels kind of rote, and there's, you know, there's not there's sort of no creativity to it, and I'm not sure that you can get as much out of those sorts of evaluations. But I think if a board hasn't done any sort of evaluation, that's a good place to start. But then as they, if they really want to look closely at how they're functioning, I think bringing in a third party, it makes the most sense. And Sherry and I distinguish ourselves from many of the providers in that we both had the in-house experience. We've done this with our boards as in-house people. We're lawyers. We understand the implications of it. That we understand that the boards are there to, you know, to meet their fiduciary duties as lawyers, to the extent the attorney-client privilege would apply. You know, we
and
get
there's
the
some shrinking involved because you're handling people.
We interview people. We like to do both written questionnaires because we feel that there are certain kind of questions that you can get out of the way more easily with a written questionnaire. And then we like to do oral interviews with each of the directors. I will say at the outset, though, we like to interview the board leadership and senior management and try to figure out why it is they want a third party to come in. Is there something in particular we should be paying attention to? Or is it just this their first time having a third party in? But, you know, we want to really focus on the particular company and tailor our questions and our questionnaire to what's going on with them.
And the advantage of a third party evaluator, one of them, is that there's directors might be more open? Is that?
I think we've found that they will be very candid with us, whereas I think if they're working with the in-house corporate secretary that they know and work with all the time, or one of their fellow board members, or the board chair, or sometimes even their outside counsel, who is their regular outside counsel, I think there might be some hesitation, even if they're not conscious of it. But what we have found is that board members will be very candid with us. We really appreciate that too, because we can be more effective with them if they open up and talk to us.
And knowing both of you, you're the kind of people that I would open up to. I mean, you're very, you know what I mean? You're not threatening.
Yeah. Thank you.
but we are also very good at telling the truth to people, and we don't hesitate to really lay it on the line. We might do it in a polite way, but we have had several evaluations where we've had to give people really some pretty tough news to hear about how badly they are functioning or areas where they really need to change their processes.
Also, you'll play the heavy, and after the results are tabulated, you'll
correct.
Get the approval from the corporate secretary, even the governance chair, I guess, to go ahead and
give our results back, and we always give them, we try anyway to always give them back both in a written form but also in an oral format. And we work with people on their disclosure also of what has happened in the evaluation.
I don't think I have the courage to play that role.
Anything that we leave in writing is very carefully drafted and in the form of recommendations, you know, consider this or, you know, so we're very careful about
it. And it's all anonymous in terms of who the source of the comments.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, you have sort of paraphrasing quotes that people even said about.
Yes, especially if we see trends. You know, usually if there's an issue, it'll come up from more than one board member, or if they're having a problem with one of the board members. Everybody knows it. You know, it's just they don't have a vehicle to raise it properly, and so sometimes it's just easier to bring in a third party to start the conversation, and a part of our role is to give them the truth, to speak to the whole board and tell them what in our opinion and what we've heard from them, where there's some improvements and where they're doing well too. We always point out, you know, what things we see that where they're doing a really good job, and then we are often asked to give the individual director their feedback if they've engaged in a peer review, which increasingly boards are starting to do, and the investors really want them to be looking at the effectiveness of the individual directors, because how can you really think about the effectiveness of a board itself if you're not looking about how the individual directors are performing, right? So, but you asked a question about, you know, how does this start? The corporate secretary, I'll get a call from a corporate secretary. Usually the first question is, how much does this cost? And so I say, well, why don't we talk for a few minutes? Let me understand what's happening with your board. Why is it that you want to talk to a third party about, doing the evaluation? And at the bottom line, it depends on the scope. You know, I've heard ranges from $25,000 to $100,000, you know. So, and we're not there. We're not up at $100,000, but we're going to keep working on it. It very much depends on the scope of the project and what the issues are, and if it's a really complex situation or if there's a large board involved, because just taking the time to interview 25 board members takes a long time.
Well, let me ask Sherry, what I was just thinking, like, how do you're doing one-on-one interviews? Does it often happen that you're perhaps doing them all in one day, that the board's gathered for a board meeting, or is this?
No, we usually do them outside of board meeting times because there's too much going on when a board or committee is meeting. We ask if and sometimes we're most of the time we're allowed to. We ask to sit in on board meetings and committee meetings so that we can see how the board functions.
Genius.
Before we start our process, but we don't do the interviews then. We have them scheduled usually through the corporate secretary's office or the CEO's office, and then we sometimes do follow up by phone. A lot of times it's by phone because directors are scattered all over the country, so we can't do them all in person, but that's the main process.
And the board members are really they're very able to open up to us on the phone too. I mean, because then they we're not in front of them, you know. So they tell us the truth, and we tell them the truth back.
So do you think this one of the hot topics today in governance is board refreshment? There's pressure
absolutely
from investors on boards, and part of it's related to board diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that driving more third-party evaluations because boards are under more scrutiny, or they're not related quite yet?
It might be. Yes, I think board succession, board refreshment, board tenure, you know, you can call it a lot of things, and having that be a part of the board evaluation, I think that's where the individual director effectiveness comes in. And while, I mean, we're working on a skills assessment now with a company that it's not like they want to change anything now, but they know that they have a couple of retirements coming up. And so they're being very proactive in saying, what is it that we're really going to need on our board when these wonderful people leave us? What, you know, and let's think about that in light of our current strategy and, you know, what
so
we
you're
need.
Helping them evaluate the
skills.
The
we're looking
board
at their
matrix.
Mm-hmm, yes, exactly. We're doing this skills assessment. We're identifying the current skills on the board, and not just, you know, their experience as CEO or whatever the experience is, but what does that mean? What does that bring to the board? Does that bring leadership qualities? Does that bring, you know, are they collegial when they're in? You know, we're looking at the whole thing, and so I think what we'll leave this board with are some ideas about skills and experience and attributes that they might want to supplement the board with when these other people are nearing retirement. And we've even talked about having some crossover with the existing board members. You know, if they can expand the board for a short time to have crossover so you don't lose, so they get the benefit of what these people who are
leaving.
That's
a smart idea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've seen that before. But it must happen, or maybe the directors that are leaving sit in an advisory capacity for a couple of meetings.
Well, I think it's not completely unheard of to have a new board member come on before the old board member leaves. Depends on the situation, you know. But this is a very planned one, and they could certainly do it.
So, Sherry, do you actually create the matrix for some of your clients, or do they already have a matrix?
Oh, so yeah, no, we're starting from scratch usually. And it's a combination of talking to the people, the leadership of the company, about what they tell us, and then also looking at what other boards have and what trends are, what investors are interested in. You know, the role of boards has also changed over time, and there's increasing, I think, pressure from investors saying, you know, you really are not just there to rubber stamp management, you're there to challenge them and to lead in some ways lead them, or at least be creative with them. So I think that is also driving more interest in doing board evaluations, because it's not just about who you know anymore to put on the board, even though that, unfortunately, I think is still a fairly common way that directors come on boards. But increasingly they're coming on boards because there's a particular need, or the company has identified that there's a gap on their particular board, and board evaluations really help them, and skills assessments really help them find directors that are going to actually help the company as opposed to just fill a seat on the board.
We're down to the fun part, and Chris has been a part of my Women's 100 events, so some of these questions might be familiar to you, but the first question is, if you had to do it all over again, what would be another career choice? What would you want to be when you grow up?
Oh, that's so interesting. I hadn't actually thought about that. I think actually a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I really like that. I really like listening to people and trying to be objective and offering suggestions where it makes sense.
Sherry?
Oh, this will sound really off the wall. I think I would be a cosmologist. I just love cosmology, and I'm taking a class right now on the search for other Earths, and I love the combination of physics and philosophy and religion and atheism and scientific method, and I think it's just really fun, and we're finally getting some of the technology that enables us to really see beyond our solar system and understand the universe. So I think that's what I would do, although I don't have the math skills, I have to say.
So you might be on SpaceX going to Mars?
Yeah.
Chris, what's the top bucket list item you've crossed off? What, other than family or career, what is something cool or unusual that you've done?
Well, for me, it does go back to family. I adopted my daughter as a single mom now 24 years ago when, you know, it wasn't as common. And that was a pretty amazing thing. I knew I didn't want to go through life without having a kid. And since I wasn't able to do that ordinary ways, I, you know, went out and found other ways to do it. And she's, you know, my greatest joy, so.
Yeah, Sherry?
Well, I would say my husband, who's now deceased, and I used to travel a lot. And so my two favorite things that I did in life were going to Antarctica and going to India.
Wow.
And those were both just trips of a lifetime, and I would do them both again if I had a chance.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who's been to Antarctica.
Antarctica, oh yeah.
Antarctica,
oh.
I can't even pronounce it.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
How does that even come up? Where do we want to go? Let's go to Antarctica.
You know, I don't even know how it came up. It was a fascinating trip, our very first trip that we've gone twice, I guess, or maybe three times. And our first trip was a cruise from Cape Town, South Africa to Santiago, Chile, and it stopped in Antarctica on the way. And it was really, so it was just part of that trip. And that's when I just fell in love with the place.
You got the teaser.
Yeah, so we went back. And as I say, I think we went back a third time as well. But it's like going to the moon. It's like no other place on Earth. It's just fascinating.
So Chris, what is something that you haven't done yet that you might want to do, even if it's not in the realm of possibility?
I think I'd like to travel more. You know, I have this boyfriend that I've had for a few years now, and he has a place down in Puerto Vallarta, and he has a studio. He's an artist. And so going down there, and what, you know what I love about that? Is going back to the same place. Going back to a house, I can even leave things there, and they're still, you know, they're waiting for me when we come back. I love that. I love just being able to get away, and I always take my computer, but it's just such a different environment, you know, and it's just so much fun. I just love it.
Relaxing.
Yeah.
So, Sherry, maybe I stole your thunder. Maybe you do want to go to Mars. What is your...
Actually, no, I'm not sure I want to get in a rocket ship. It's like, you know, being on top of a hydrogen bomb or something. But that does make me a little nervous. I'll wait for the teleportation to happen. I don't know. I'm in a period of transition right now because my husband died recently. And so I guess I'm sort of waiting till I get through this period of adjustment where everything is new all over again. But I do, you know, I'm a feminist from way back. And I really would like to be around and involved in finally getting us to sort of a gender equity in business and in life, and maybe not even gender. I don't even know what the right word is now, just sort of ignoring those issues and just focusing on people's talents and what they bring to the party. And I feel like I do that a little bit with some of these board evaluations, because we're able to talk to people without regard to what their gender is and try and help them see how they're being effective or not. But I don't see it happening in a lot of places in the world. And so I'd like to really figure out how could I be part of that.
That's nice. So now we're general life advice. What is something you would leave the audience with?
Well, I would say this is nothing new, but it really is when you find something that makes you happy, pursue it. You know, as long as you're not hurting somebody else in the process, just do it. I mean, like, as I said, I went out and made a family for myself, and I'm so happy that I did that. It was the right thing, you know.
I think they made a song, Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Yeah. It's a good song. But really, I mean, in your work, if there's something that you really, really like, just do it.
Focus on that.
Yeah.
Sherry?
So I would say that being helpful to others is a really important thing. A lot of people in business are much more concerned about themselves and their own career and don't take the time to be helpful to other people. And I think that one of the things that helped make me a success as a corporate secretary was that I was able to really be helpful to other people, because I could see things that they could do that would help them in their career. And it really helped me, because other people saw that and they kept pushing me upward. So I would say being helpful to other people is really important.
It's rewarding for
life
yourself,
and yeah. Career advice both.
Well, we have a party to get to. Here at the Society of Corporate Secretaries Annual Conference. Thanks very much, Chris Vico and Sherry Sorokin.
Thank you, Brock.